Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thank you. How are you?
Good, yeah, man. Really good morning.
Okay, here he comes. I'm letting him in. John, right? Is this from Texas?
Yes, sir.
Wait. Sorry, I'm scattered. I just jumped out of the shower. Hello.
Me too. All good.
Hello, everyone. John, your microphone is off.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we got you.
Cool.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Cool. I'm Ryan. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Ryan.
That other guy, I don't know which side he shows up for you. That's true.
Yeah. Producer, yeah.
Cool. Sorry, guys. I'm just a little scattered. I just I got a little behind in my day, and I just jumped out of the shower and went, oh, crap, we're starting in 3 minutes. So
I sent you John's info to the Life Autistic.
Okay, Gmail. Thank you, sir. I'm going to print
that. Thanks for sending that along, John.
Yeah, I just, to cope with anxiety last night, I wrote that little narrative just to kind of give myself some direction so I don't get completely off track. So,
cool.
We feel you. We feel you on that. Amazing. What time is it where you are again, John? Is it 2 or 3 hours behind?
It's 1:30 Central Time, so, and you guys are probably in the Eastern Time Zone, right?
Yeah, so we're 2:30 right now. So John, just so you know, totally get it on any anxiety or anything. We tend to do this show like we just try to keep it pretty chill and just like, you know, I ramble, I stutter, I lose my train of thought all the time. And we don't edit any of that out. I don't care. I just want it to be real and be just like who we really are. I want that's kind of what I want the world to see. And I want us to see in each other of just like being kind of free to just be who we are and not have to hide. So I don't know if what I just said helps you at all. But I hope it does. Also, if there's anything like tomorrow or the next day, if you look back and you think there's something you said that you don't want us to publish, like let us know and we'll edit that out. It's not a big deal. Cool. So
cool. I don't think it'd be a problem, but
yeah. So I don't know. I just like to let people know that, you know, it's we're. Sorry, I'm just going to print that thing that you sent us so I can kind of look over it while we're talking.
Yeah, I apologize. This is kind of a little, it's 4 pages. But
Hey man, it's all good. No worries. I apologize. I didn't read it already. I just, yeah.
You know how we are. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think I communicate better in writing than talking, you know, I'm getting better at talking. But...
Yeah. I feel like sometimes that's the case. And other times I do enjoy talking because there's sometimes I find in the, like, just rambling on and going wherever the thoughts take you, I end up sometimes finding, like, you just end up somewhere and you go, oh, this is a cool place to be. And I don't know if I would have got here if I didn't follow like 27 other thoughts to get to this place.
Yeah, it's very zen. It's like wandering through a library and you're looking for one specific thing and then you stumble on this one book that you didn't even know was there and you're like, oh, wow.
It's so true. I used to love doing that. Just like when I was in high school, I would often just go in the evenings, go walk through the library and you just walk down the aisles and subjects catch your eye that you don't even know you're interested in. You pull a book out and you check it out. Mm-hmm. So have you heard any episodes of the show before? Or
I think I'm caught up with all the episodes that are out there. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So
he's a fan.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You, like, I should have known that. I'm out of it still. Okay. I got last week. I was talking to my daughter who's five and we were talking about toys and I mentioned her. I said, oh, I've got these two bins of old G.I. Joe toys in the shed from when I was a kid. I haven't looked in these boxes for 20 years, probably. So she just goes, oh yeah, I want to see them. So I go dig out the shed, pull them in the house. They're all covered in dust, wash them off. I'm like washing and drying them. She starts playing with them. She's loving it, freaking out. But I don't have many female characters. So my daughter says, can you get some girl ones? So for the last week, I've just been online trying to find female characters. And then it's reignited this childhood G.I. Joe obsession that I had. And now I'm like, shit, I don't need this in my life right now. Now I'm obsessed with G.I. Joe. I tracked down the G.I. Joe movie. I tracked down the G.I. Joe movie from 1987. And I watched it this morning. And that's what fucked up my day.
Big announcement. This is our last show. Ryan's going G.I. Joe after this.
Because I should have been like reading this and like preparing for this.
No stress, man. No stress.
Instead, I was just drinking like coffee and obsessively watching G.I. Joe and looking on eBay trying to find female characters to get for my daughter. And it's like, and then I was the whole time kicking myself going, what are you doing, man? Like,
I think it's so fucking cool that you have a kid and you manage, you know, your life and you entertain your daughter. So I only have a dog. So you're impressing me.
So no, thanks. We'll see. I'm just walking guys to get my coffee, but,
the show must go on.
So John, we want to welcome you. Thank you for being a part of this. I don't know. You want to tell us a bit about you?
Yeah, well, thank you, Ryan, for having me come on. I am a adult cishet, white American male Aspie. It's been 10 years since my diagnosis. My 10-year anniversary was last July in 2020, so I was diagnosed in the summer of 2010. Wow. And I can say that, you know, getting diagnosis and meeting other Aspies in my local area definitely made a lot of events in my past make a lot more sense. You know, it's like turning on a lamp and shining a light that illuminates the shadows of, you know, what was in the past and only dimly understood, you know. So it's been quite a journey, and I'm still learning,
yeah,
for sure. Professionally, I am a librarian. I work for my local county library system as an interlibrary loan clerk. That basically means any books that we don't have in the system, I try to get them from other libraries that our patrons want, and vice versa. I cover for my colleague who loans our material when they don't have a book, but we can supply it. We'll send it out by courier or postal service. And it's pretty gratifying work. I got my library science degree back in 2004, and I have a previous master's in German studies from Rice University, And my bachelor's is in history and German from Texas A&M University way back in 1994.
So, wow. That's awesome.
And I lived in Germany for a year as an exchange student. I still think I speak near native fluency in German.
Yeah.
My Russian used to be better, but it's kind of high beginner status now. And my Spanish at its height was kind of solid intermediate level. It's again got a little rusty, but I try to listen to the Spanish radio and TV stations around here to kind of brush up some.
Yeah.
So I love foreign languages as one of my passions.
Wow. So, that's really cool. Do you find like, do you have a natural aptitude for languages or?
I seem to, and I think I have a good ear for things, for music and whatnot. I can kind of pick out things. And so I think that really helps a lot. And I'm pretty good with my pronunciation too. I try to get it as accurate as I can. My German at one point got to a point where native Germans couldn't immediately tell that I was an American. Some of them even thought I was German, which was pretty cool.
That is cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Right on. So you said you were diagnosed 10 years ago. At what age was that again?
I was, let's see. Well, I'm my 50th birthday will be on Monday. So
good for you. Cool.
Almost 40, 30, age 39. Yeah.
Nice.
Age 39.
Mm-hmm. So I'm always curious with other people, because I was just diagnosed last fall at age 44. I always say after a whole life of wondering what the fuck was wrong with me. Excuse my language, but so what, when you look back, well, first of all, I guess I'll ask you, like, what prompted that process of diagnosis for you? And then after that, we'll kind of, I'm always curious about, like, what, once you got that diagnosis, looking back on your childhood, what looks different?
Right. Well, basically, what prompted my seeking diagnosis, as I said, I'm a librarian. I got my library degree back in 2004, and I've held positions as professional librarian at a couple of universities, and now I work for a public library system. But with the first university I worked for, I was hired for a six-month probationary period, and my contract was not renewed, and I kind of was mystified as to why I was let go. And I mean, there were reasons, my boss gave them, but it just seemed really grossly unfair. And but you know, it happened. And so I fell back on my previous job, which was with AIG International Services, which is a assistance company that provides customer support 24 hours for travel insurance policyholders.
Yeah.
And I really liked that job. I'll talk more about that one later, but I worked for them in the interim, and then I managed to get hired by Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas. I was hired in 2008, and I worked all the way through all of 2008, 2009, and then was finally let go around Christmas 2009. Okay. My first year evaluation was good. Everything seemed to be on the up and up and going smoothly, and I liked my job and lived near the campus. I could walk to work every day. It was great. Nice. But that second year, things just fell apart, and I couldn't really understand why. And I just got on my boss's bad side, and things soured, and I was let go again. Or I was asked, do you want me to resign? And she said yes, and said, okay, well, I'm out.
Wow.
She engaged in a lot of bullying and pressure and made my life basically hell, that I was ready to go by that point anyway. But
yeah.
So I came back here, back to Sugarland, Texas, and was unemployed for 6 months. And so I was kind of like listless and focusing on weight loss, because it was the one goal I could put, you know, one foot in front of the other. And just, and my mom was actually the one that had been reading up on Asperger's and said, well, why don't you go down to the University of Texas Behavioral Sciences Center and get evaluated for this thing. Maybe you have it. Cause I first read through it, I was like, well, I don't know. But then I was like, well, I've lost two jobs in a row for a reason I don't fully understand. I'm willing to try anything at this point to, gain some knowledge and insight, right, maybe. And I'm so glad that I did, You know, I went in and met with Dr. Loveland and took the evaluation exam and everything. And like almost right after I got my results back, I got hired by the local library system here in Fort Bend County. And, you know, so I started working there. And I went from one bullying boss to another bullying boss, unfortunately. And so those first couple of years at Fort Bend were really hell. And, but I, and in fact, that first year I was probably within about a week of getting fired. I could tell just from the ultimatums that my boss was laying down and the way she was, just kind of having a sword over my head, basically. And I finally, I hadn't disclosed when I was hired and I didn't want to disclose.
Yeah.
But I kind of felt backed into a corner. And so I finally produced my diagnosis letter in my last, you know, what would have been my last week. And that made her back off. And county HR stepped in and kind of put a leash on her and made her pull back and say, okay, okay, we got to give this guy some accommodations. And, you know, so, and I got the local, Arc of Fort Bend. That's a local community organization that, ARC used to stand for Association of Retarded Citizens, but they also do advocacy for neurodiverse individuals as well.
Okay.
So I had an advocate on my side in negotiating with the library system and library and county HR.
Yeah.
And I had to agree to take a demotion to the next rank down. So it was a slight pay cut too. But I, in exchange and for a modification of my job duties, I was allowed to stay on full time with benefits. Yeah. So it was a little humiliating, but it was worth it to save my job, you know?
Yeah.
And my boss, you know, after that treated me with even more contempt.
Really?
She treated me as if I was like intellectually slow when I was probably smarter than she was, but I just kind of, you know, gritted my teeth and bore it, you know, and, I've eventually just outlasted her. She eventually got hoisted on her own petard from her own hubris. She got too big for her britches, crossed swords with the library director and got bounced. So
okay.
And we were all much relieved after that day.
Yeah.
We got a new boss who's a lot more benevolent and understanding and still my boss today. So I'm, you know, life's been a lot better since that time.
That's good. And you're open with that new boss. Like it's open with your autism. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She knows about it and we're cool with it. And
And she's been, like accommodating with that or.
Yeah. Well, and she was also a victim of the previous boss. She was the assistant cataloger under this terrible boss. And the terrible boss was trying to run her off too. So she had firsthand experience of what that was like. So we all kind of,
part of me is just fantasizing about working in a library. It sounds so awesome, but I know every job has its politics and its personalities and its ins and outs, but just like I'm just like, oh my god, if I could just spend my entire working days like sorting books, I'd be so happy. But
not that easy.
No,
it's funny, right? When I look back, Ryan, it's like I'm going in here. I am a 30 something autistic male going into a profession that's dominated by mostly NT females. What could possibly go wrong?
It's like,
so I mean, it's been a hard road to hoe, you know, in librarianship, because there has been a lot of misunderstandings and having to negotiate things. I can remember a specific anecdote from Texas Women's University. Like every month we would have a staff meeting. We'd all gather together in a circle and kind of give the boss an update on what we were doing and everything. And that was in the written rules. And so I followed those things to the T. But what I didn't pick up on was there was also these informal things like that I only saw after the fact that, everyone kind of goes by Chris's office once a week to just chat and stuff. And I didn't. And so since it wasn't written down as a formal procedure, I didn't pick up on it that was an expected thing. And so I didn't. And that apparently really pissed her off. And it's like, I can't know that I'm doing wrong if you don't say anything. So, and at my first library job down in Galveston, I was fresh out of library school and thrown in as the head technical services librarian. And, you know, in library school, you learn kind of the general principles and the high-minded ideals of librarianship, but they don't teach you concrete things like this is how this integrated library system from this specific vendor works and blah, blah, blah. And you have to kind of learn that on the job. And I even begged my boss to give me, you know, to give, there was training being offered by the vendor in our specific cataloging system. And it's like, I really need this, you know, boss, can I sign up for this? She's like, no, you don't need that. You're fine. You can, you know, pick it up from your assistant cataloger and whatnot. And I was so dependent on my assistant cataloger to kind of do the finishing steps that it looked like I wasn't cataloging anything because her stamp was on the final product. And it's like, no, I did the work, but there was no way I could prove it, you know? And because I was lacking in knowledge on how to do certain steps with the system, you know, I was like hobbled from the beginning. And then she sent me off to the vendor training in Chicago, which was great. And I finally had a breakthrough and was like, okay, now I understand what I need to do with this and this. And I came back ready to work and I was let go the very next day when I got back from the trip.
What? Are you kidding me?
Sucks.
Nope.
after a research trip.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
No.
It makes no sense at all.
No sense at all.
Except for it was just the timing of it. If they kept me on, they would have had to start paying me benefits and have to take me on full time. It'd be a lot harder to fire me.
Oh yeah.
So she'd already made up her mind. The trip had been paid for, but she already made up her mind that I was going to go. And so I went to Chicago for nothing. Although it was fun. I got to see Spam a lot and
oh, nice.
Played hooky one afternoon and went to the Chicago Institute of Art and wondered.
Yes. I was going to ask you, did you go to the Institute of Art? It's fantastic.
And the bean there and everything. Yeah, that was cool.
Did you see that they have a few Monets there, I believe?
Yeah. Yeah. It was great.
Cool.
John, can I just ask you something strange that just keeps reoccurring in my mind?
Sure. Go ahead.
Like, you seem like so intelligent. Like, I just wonder what would your dream job be?
Well, probably an academic librarian at a university setting. I would have said cataloging at one point, but I've been out of the cataloging game so long now, I don't think I can do it. But doing interlibrary loan, but as a professional librarian, you know, in a nice research university in a cool college town kind of thing would be kind of what I would still think I would really like to do eventually.
Yeah.
But I can tell you this, one job that actually was kind of my dream job for a while was that job with AIG International Services. And I'll tell you why. It was a 24-hour call center with a multi-ethnic staff, multilingual staff. They hired me because I could speak German and translate German documents. And they also sometimes would have me do the best I can with Dutch documents and other Germanic languages, and just to give them an idea of the gist of what was being written and stuff. And they encouraged me to keep up my other language studies. So with Spanish, I didn't, you know, like if I had to call a hotel, I could at least say, yes, I need so-and-so in room such-and-such without having to get one of our Spanish speakers to do it for me, you know, and things like that. And so, and then I even got to use my Russian on the job once, you know, I spoke it terribly, but the guy at least understood what I wanted. So,
yeah,
you know, I made it work. And that, I loved that job. I really did. And I never would have left it, but my mother would keep ragging on me year after year, John, that job doesn't pay you enough. You can do better than that job. Why don't you do something that, you know, pays you what you're worth? And it's like, yeah, but Mom, I love it. Wouldn't let up with it. And she's a librarian. She's a school librarian. And I've always been kind of academically oriented. You know, before I went to work for AIG, I had the ambition of becoming a German professor and being kind of an academic. But I got so burned out doing my master's thesis. I was like, well, maybe I don't want to do that. I don't know. But I've always loved the life in and around a college town and just all the really deep intellectual discussions you can find in a college town. And I really miss that a lot. And but the job with AIG, it was like, I got to use my language skills. It was challenging. It was stressful, but it was fun. And I was making a difference. I was actually saving people's lives by getting them an air ambulance or getting them a medical escort or whatever. And it was very gratifying work. You know, but for my mother hounding me, I'd probably still be working there unless, you know, of course now AIG went through a bankruptcy in 2008 or, you know, 2009.
Yeah.
And so maybe I couldn't have gone back, you know, and in fact, I tried to go back and they had a hiring freeze as part of their condition of being bailed out by the U.S. government. That's why I'm not back there now.
Wow.
And then just, you know, landed the current job I have. And so I haven't tried to go back since. So, and they're also changing their organizational structure, and they're kind of downsizing the Houston office and moving assets to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, which was a different company that they bought out. And they did offer me to, they said, well, we'll hire you in Stevens Point, but you have to pay the moving costs. I'm like, well, that's kind of a lot. And also I don't have any friends or family in that part of the Midwest. So I'd be out there all by myself. And I'm an only child. My parents are elderly. And so I was like, I just don't think I could do that, you know?
Yeah. That makes sense. Wow.
But your folks are in Texas, John.
Yeah. Yeah. I live in with my elderly mother here. My father passed away, back in 2019, unfortunately, but he was, but yeah, we all lived together. Once I started working for Fort Bend County Library System. So,
cool. I want to ask you about your childhood. I mean, going back, I know for me, when I started exploring, you know, being autistic, when I figured it out and actually said, yeah, okay, this is what it is. And then went through the process of the assessment, diagnosis, et cetera. I know looking back on my life now, it's just like, I think for about 6 months, I just was like going back through all these different memories. And it's like just seeing it all with a different lens and just going, oh, that's what was going on there. That's why I was doing that. That's what that. So I'm curious about you, like if you have any specific memories or things from your childhood that were kind of signs, or also looking back, if there are things that you notice now that maybe didn't seem that different at the time.
Yeah, I can tell if one specific, you know, anecdote, like I know that when I was a child in the late 70s and stuff, I used to love to listen to, you know, country and rock tunes on 45 singles and stuff. And I would play them over and over and over again. It would drive my parents crazy.
Yeah.
But I was entertained by it. And then but looking back after diagnosis, I'm like, oh man, that's kind of a red flag, isn't it? You know? And then I know that I tended to play by myself at kindergarten and after school daycare and stuff, you know, unless a kid had a specific, like, I remember I interacted with one kid because he had a Battlestar Galactica toy, whatever. I walked over, I was like, oh, hey man, that's cool. I love that show, blah, blah, blah. But unless there was a prompt like that, I tended to just play by myself and lost in my own head a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And then as far as like school friends and stuff, I tended to have a tight circle of very deep friends rather than a wide circle of just casual friends and stuff. I didn't really do the whole casual friend thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I liked having really meaningful conversation, hours long conversations with friends, you know, either on the phone or just standing outside their head, you know, like we'd go through the formal ritual of saying goodbye and then we'd kind of be just talking out on the street. I'm leaning up against my car and we're just talking for hours and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's
awesome. What about like in, up into like high school years, anything there that kind of looks different now?
In high school, my big thing back then was German club. And also I was a cadet in the NJROTC program, which is set up by the Department of the U.S. Navy. And it's kind of a cadet program. It's building citizenship and teaching you about the armed forces and the Navy. And you wear a uniform once a week and they have after school activities, like you can shoot air pistols and or march in the color guard or do drill team. And so I did a lot of those things. Ultimately became drill team commander my senior year. That was a lot of fun.
Okay.
But it's funny because after diagnosis, I realized just what an ASPE friendly environment our naval science instructor had created for us in ways that I couldn't have verbalized at the time, but like when you came to our school in the morning, students were expected to go to the commons area, you know, where they have lunch, and it got loud and crazy and I hated it.
Yeah.
But the ROTC room, the captain would open the door and it was up on the second floor. And as long as we were quiet and studied quietly in the classroom, he was fine with us being there and stuff. So I would go up there kind of as a retreat from all of the chaos downstairs.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, just kind of looking back with my mind's eye, I think there were a lot of undiagnosed ASD kids in ROTC together. People with a lot, you know, like guys that had really focused interest on survival gear or Army Navy surplus stuff, or, you know, knew all of the insignia from such and such army, or, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, it's like looking back and see, I'm sure I had fellow Aspies in the unit back then.
Yeah.
So
there's a guy, there's a guy in the support group that I go to who's like, he's a senior citizen, and he had a whole lifelong career in the military and only discovered he was autistic after he retired. And one of the things I was told about that is that he did really well in the structured environment of the military, because everything's clear. You know what the rules are. There's a chain of command. Everything's kind of black and white. Yes, no. Yep. And he did well. And then when he came out and retired and was kind of faced with, you know, a blurry world, I guess you could say, he struggled. And then, you know, I don't know exactly how old he was, but I think he was in his, maybe in his 60s when he was diagnosed. I don't know. I find that interesting. It actually, I was considering, even a couple of years ago, I was like seriously considering, even though I was like 40, I was thinking of joining the military, even though it's really late. Cause I thought, God, I've had like 30 different jobs my whole life. And I just, everything, all, it's always, blah. And I thought maybe that would be the one place where I'd actually feel kind of okay, because maybe the structure would be really good for me. So I don't know.
Yeah. So my first career ambition was actually to become a Navy officer.
Yeah.
But a little history, like back then, my eyesight, I had LASIK done in 2004, but we're talking in the late 80s here, and my glasses were as thick as Coke bottles.
Okay.
And so I went to Texas A&M, which has its world famous Corps of Cadets, and I enrolled and actually did well enough my first semester, my freshman year, to win a Navy scholarship.
Oh, wow.
But it was dependent on passing the physical in the spring. So I did that and went to Naval Air Station Dallas and got checked out and everything. And the problem was that my eyesight was beyond the limits for which they would grant a waiver. Okay. So I had my Navy scholarship stripped from me.
Oh.
And so I couldn't get commissioned through the RTC, and losing that reason for being there, I dropped out of the program altogether because I didn't see the point in staying on.
Yeah.
So I went to enjoy civilian life as a regular student, and then got involved with the Texas A&M German Club, and eventually got to go overseas to Germany to be an exchange student for a year, which I wouldn't have been able to do if I was still a cadet. So,
oh, that's cool. Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, trite, but, you know, life closes one door, opens up another one. So
it's true.
Those companies where they come.
Yeah. It's funny though. I think about that kind of structure. Even like I bartend now, and I it's sort of a chaotic situation, but I just like create this little pocket of order behind the bar where like everything goes in the exact same spot, and I make every drink the exact same way every time. So it's like, even when it's busy and crazy and I got to pump out 1,000 cocktails, it's like, there's there's like a calm within that chaos, because I just know I'm just kind of repeating the same thing over and over again. And it's the same kind of, like just executing the same movements constantly. It's kind of, I don't know.
I'm like that in my kitchen.
What's that?
I'm like that in our kitchen. Things have to be like, my wife can operate with things going in different places after they come out of the dishwasher, but she's very nicely like, listened and said, okay, I'll put this back in this drawer because it just throws me off so much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
One more thing I can say. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
One more thing I can tell you about my childhood. I am adopted, and, looking through my adoption paperwork, I've gotten everything that's legally obtainable through the state of Georgia, where I was born.
Yeah.
And like, they have non-identifying information about your biological parents.
Okay.
And so there's kind of like a narrative summary of their bios, basically. And
yeah.
I think that my biological father was probably the one that was on the spectrum. You know, Oh, granted, wow. it's you're reading between the lines and looking back at 1970s, but they described him as a intelligent but nervous man.
Yeah.
And he was the son of a doctor and, you know, and really into sports to an obsessive degree, I think. And so, mm-hmm. And my biological mother was, he was a about to graduate senior from his undergraduate college. And then my biological mother was a college sophomore, and they had a hookup in the summer of 1970. And then I came along, and he professed that he loved her and wanted to marry her, but she didn't feel that way about him. And so they didn't. But that was interesting. And then, like you were talking about with that older gentleman, I have my adopted family. I love my mom and dad. I think that my adopted dad, actually was probably on the spectrum too, you know, looking back, because he always had trouble making adult friends. He really didn't have that many adult friends. He was a teacher, a science teacher, and kind of a lonely guy, and just kind of kept to himself a lot, and a little bit quirky, a little weird, but and I think that we sometimes had a rocky relationship in a way, because we were almost too similar. Like, there were things that he didn't like about himself, but he would see them reflected in me and direct that anger at me sometimes, or, you know, so there was just tension there sometimes, nothing violent or bad, but just unease at times. And, but my mom even had suggested, well, do you think your dad is on the spectrum? And at the time, this was like right after my diagnosis, I wasn't ready to accept that yet. But with 10 years of life on the spectrum and awareness, and looking back more at my dad's life, I'm prepared to say, yeah, I think he probably was, actually. So,
yeah.
Ryan, what about you? Any of your parents, do you think, have autism or on the spectrum?
I don't know. My father passed when I was 14, and I didn't know him that well. There are some things there that I think make me think it's possible, but I really just don't know. My mom, no, I don't. And then I don't see anything as far as grandparents or anything. Ironically enough, I don't know if I should say this, because I don't know if they listen to the show, but anyway, I'll say it. I don't think he listens to it. I think my stepdad is like, I'm 98% certain that he he's on the spectrum, but I don't know that he would be open to that conversation. So it's not something I ever would bring up with him. He's a great guy. I love him. He's kind and generous, but he's really quirky and really, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of rigid in his thinking and in his action and in his behavior, in his habits. So, I don't know. I hope he doesn't listen to this. I don't think he does, but man,
sorry I asked you, man.
No, it's okay. But yeah, no, I don't. I wonder about that, because this is a genetic thing, and this is a thing that a lot of people, I mean, a lot of adults I've spoken to that have discovered their own autism in adulthood. Oftentimes it comes after discovering it in their children. You know, you hear from that. I think Rose talked about that. You hear from that, like, people, their kids are going through that diagnosis and assessment process, and then the parents are there during that process, and they're hearing these questions and hearing this stuff. And then they start going, huh, that's me, you know? So I think a lot of people get there through that, but I don't know. I wonder, I mean, I wish sometimes that, you know, if my grandparents were still alive, then maybe I could kind of have those conversations with them and those interactions where I could sort of look and go, let me kind of see, you know, like, because I think in some ways, like, you know, like they say, like, gay people have gaydar. I think in some ways there's sort of like a similar thing with when neurodiversity or autism. Like, what's that?
I call it my autisticator.
Your autisticator. Yeah. There's sometimes you talk to someone and you just go, oh, I know. I see it. There it is. But you don't know if you can say it because you don't know if they know or if they want to know.
Yeah. Ultimately, they kind of have to discover it for themselves. But yes. I think we're pretty good at picking out our own when we encounter them in the wild.
Yeah.
And I think on that topic, I'm looking back. I think my ex-wife was probably on the spectrum as well.
Yeah.
Because she was kind of shunned traditional conventions of feminine beauty. Like she would wear camouflage pants and cut her hair just at the shoulder here. And
yeah.
She was quirky and strange and in a good way.
Yeah.
And we clicked and it was just, it didn't last the long term, but we definitely were very much into each other in the beginning and stuff. Yeah. The problem was that we were kind of united by what we were against at the time. Like both of us were against the Iraq war and against the Bush administration. But unfortunately, like, she's religious. I'm not. And she didn't have a problem with that at first, but over the course of the two years of our relationship and after our marriage, especially, she just got fed up with being married to a non-believer and got really emotionally abusive about it. And I just eventually had to walk out of that relationship.
I'm sorry, man.
Abuse anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Had you guys been considering children or did you have children or?
We had been, and she miscarried once, but I felt since we were both students, I was a grad student. She was a undergrad, about to graduate. She was a senior, academic senior. I thought we should really, wait until I had a job and stuff before we started having kids.
But, yeah.
When she really doubled down on her religious convictions, she eventually abandoned birth control completely and would get pissy with me when I would want to use male protection.
Yeah.
And so I just said, look, that was kind of the last straw I had to get out at that point. I'm like, this is irresponsible. We can't do this.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. I know that can be an issue with people when they're with people who are religious sometimes will be okay to date someone who isn't, but then when you get serious and you're into like marriage and wanting to have a family, then it becomes more of an issue. I've had that in my past where I'm not religious either, but I've once or twice dated women who were, and in the beginning it wasn't that big a deal, but as you get more serious, it becomes more apparent how important it is to somebody's life. How have you been in general with relationships? How do you find yourself?
I've always been awkward with girls. It's just I'm not very good at reading things, and sometimes I've gotten better at being able to pick up when I'm being flirted with, but because of my low self-esteem, I would often kind of push that thought out of my mind. Like, no, she's just being nice, or that's not really, rather than the reverse of thinking, oh, she loves me creeper and say, which I've also, stumbled a few times in that direction. I'm not proud of that, but I've learned so it's hard to find the right medium for one. And I don't know. I had one good girlfriend since being married and we lasted for about 6 months, but
yeah.
And she agreed to this beforehand that we would see each other, but if I got a library job, I had to go where the work was. And in that case, it was in North Texas. So I had to leave. So we, ended our relationship.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if starting a family and having a wife was more of a priority for me, maybe I would have stayed and tried to have kids with that girlfriend. But, I was really still dead set on my library career at that point. So I went to North Texas and, gave it the old college try for 2 years. So,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always been like completely clueless with women, like just, with everything, with friendships too. Like I read somewhere this saying that like it was about introverts, but I think it applied to me. It said something about introverts don't make friends. They just get adopted by people. And I've found that in my life, like I don't know how to make friends. I never have, but I'm lucky that throughout my life, there's been a small handful of people that have sort of adopted me. Like my couple of my best friends right now. I don't even know why they picked me to be friends, but they did. And then all of a sudden we were friends and I was like, this is cool. I don't know how it happened. I didn't do it. At least I don't feel like I did. Or if I did, I don't know how it happened, but I'm so grateful. And it's often been the same with women where the ones that I've tried to go after, I've been so awkward and terrible at it where I'm just like, they're just like, dude, get the fuck away from me. Like, you're awkward. You're weird. You're saying dumb shit. You're trying to be funny. It's not funny. You're actually sometimes being offensive because you're like trying to like flirt or be cool, but you're saying stuff that they're actually like, dude, you're an idiot. You're gross. Like, get the fuck away. But like other times where I've actually gotten into relationships, it's more often than not just kind of started out as sort of a friendship or something where all of a sudden I find myself hanging out with somebody. And then all of a sudden I go, huh, we've been hanging out for a while. This kind of feels like this person is becoming my girlfriend or something. But yeah. Again, I would have no idea how it happened. I would just kind of be like,
that's kind of how my ex-wife and I ended up together. We were both working in the same department at the university together and became friends. We'd just talk. And she was obviously very well-read and smart. And like, she was the one lady that I wooed in more or less the traditional way. And eventually ended up in her apartment and watching a movie. And I just kind of reached over and held her hand. And she thought that was so quaint and kind of old fashioned, but she liked it. And so, and then that one thing led to another and we got, you know, together and got married. So, but
I'm going to write that down. I'm going to try to hold somebody.
You wrote that down?
Yeah. I'm taking notes. This is how you do it.
Slow and steady.
Yeah.
That's nice. That's a beautiful story.
Yeah, it really is. So, I'm looking at the stuff you wrote and you mentioned alcohol abuse as a coping mechanism for social awkwardness and anxiety. And that's something that you know, I completely relate to. I was a heavy drinker for probably about 20 years. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit or?
Yeah. I mean, definitely in college that was a thing. And it just helped me, you know, overcome my reticence to talk and just, you know, loosen the tongue a bit. There was a saying in Germany, Bier löst die Zunge, or beer loosens the tongue.
Yeah.
And so I would drink with, I drank underage with the German club. Like, I would just sit on the edge of the table and people that were of age would buy a pitcher and they're just going to, you know, pour some for me and stuff on the sly. And, I just enjoyed their company and it was wrapped up with just my love of deep intellectual conversations with people in undergrad and also later in grad school and stuff. And when I finished my graduate school education, I kind of craved that. I really wanted it, but I never could find that kind of combo. So I would just drink, I taught high school German for a year, just kind of not really knowing what I wanted to do after I, you know, kind of washed out of the graduate program and couldn't go on to get a PhD. Cause that job was stressful. I came home from work every day with a splitting headache and like I would drink on a Friday night just to kind of relax and, you know, probably have too much and stuff. And, but I never drank during the week when it was time to, you know, grade papers and whatnot. So I tried to be disciplined about it, but, you know, and I have a DWI on my record and I'm not, that was not good, but that was, so that happened back, that was like for New Year's 1999 or so. And I went cold turkey for a number of years. I actually did quit and, you know, attended some AA and whatnot and didn't drink at all. I resumed drinking like in late 2010 and just moderate. And I don't, thankfully with enough age and maturity, like the feeling of getting drunk and whatever just doesn't appeal to me anymore. It's like, I've kind of outgrown that. I can have a few beers of it, on a Friday night or whatever, but you know, beyond that, I don't really, you know, want to get smashed the way I used to when I was younger.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I used to like, for many, many years, I didn't leave my house without having a beer or two first. Like, even if it was going to work, like I worked in a bar, so I didn't start work till 5 PM. So I'd be at home, you know, I'd get home from work late. So I'd often not get up till noon, but then you'd get up, you know, have a shower, eat some food, whatever. And then I'd like have a beer in the shower before I was going back to work again or something. or, you know, sometimes too. And it's, or I'd leave and walk to work and stop on the way at another bar somewhere and sit on the patio and have a pint and then go into work. And I used to be, you know, on the days when I wasn't working, like I wouldn't, you know, if I was going out in the evening, even going to with friends to meet at a bar somewhere, like I'd have two or three beers before I left the house just to get like, you know, stop the shaking, calm the nerves, feel like, okay, work myself up to be like, okay, I got to go out. I'm going to talk to people. I can do it. But if I was to just walk out of the house without drinking first, I couldn't do it. So it's funny. Like I don't drink at all anymore. And I'm not like, I'll never drink again. I just don't have any desire to right now, but yeah, I definitely can relate to you about, I never want to be drunk again. Like, I don't like that feeling. I haven't in years, like, but it's funny. I wonder how many of us, when you're undiagnosed and you just have all this like anxiety around your interactions with the world, it's a way to cope with that. But it's, I mean, how many autistics are have DWIs or are in AA or have other alcohol related issues in their life. I would imagine it's quite a bit, because that's kind of an easy thing for so many of us to just find.
It's a form of self-medication, you know, you got nothing else. You know, it's not the best solution, but it, you know.
And if you don't even know, like, if you don't even know why you're doing it, like I didn't at the time, like I'm thinking back to my 20s, I didn't have the language of saying like I have anxiety. Mm-hmm. I just knew I felt better. I just knew there was that space right between the second and third beer, and that's where I felt amazing. Mm-hmm. I didn't have words for it. It just was a discovery, and then it was just like, oh, I'll just keep repeating this. That makes sense. But I don't even think it was like that much of a conscious thing. It was just, all right, I'm getting ready to go out. I'm having a couple beers first. And it wasn't like, oh, I need to do this or I can't go out. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting thinking about these things going back.
Yeah.
But I don't miss it.
I don't miss how it makes me feel the next day. That's for sure, man.
No.
Yeah.
I tried to have a beer on a couple days before Christmas. A bunch of my old like high school buddies, like skateboarding guys I used to skateboard with in high school, like a bunch of us got on like a group Zoom call just before Christmas to chat, and I was like, I'm gonna have a beer. And I like hadn't had a beer in like 6 months. I grab one out of the fridge, pour it in a glass, I sit down on my computer, I'm like, yeah, I'm talking to my old buddies, I'm gonna have a beer. And I had like one sip, two sips, and I was just like, ugh, I don't even want it. Just, it was weird. I just don't even want it anymore. But
what do you drink now, Ryan? That can of, is it like bubbly, what is it?
Oh yeah, I just drink like sparkling water now.
Yeah same.
Interesting.
Yeah, so what about, like,
I was just gonna say another addendum to the relationship discussion, like I understand, like you said, now I have the language for this. I have very poor executive functioning skills, and so I can just remember it always was this constant feeling of anxiety, like I need to get my shit together before I can have a relationship with this person. Like, here's this person who seems interested in me, blah, 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 but I can't allow that for myself right now because I'm too fucked up. I have to, you know, get my house in order before I can, you know, proceed on to allowing myself to have this. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in my head. And then with diagnosis, I'm like, oh, that's just part of being autistic. It's always going to be that way. So, you know, don't let that hold you back.
Yeah. So
that was a interesting revelation to come to. I wish I had discovered it sooner.
For sure. I mean, and that's such a thing that can like add to those other types of feelings about Like, I know for me, like the executive function part of my life, that feeling like, oh, I got to get my shit together. I got to get organized. I got to get this. And I feel like I spend 50% of my waking hours in this panicked mode of spinning my wheels, trying to like get to some magical place called organized and just never getting there. And then, and it's like, and what that has done is constantly reinforced this feeling of failing, of being a failure. And this is something I'm working with like my coach right now on. We had a big talk about it last week of like working through this baked in feeling that I've just like reinforced my whole life of constantly every single day feeling like a failure, because every single day at the end of the day, I just feel like I'm still not organized. I still haven't figured it out. I still haven't got my shit together. Okay, tomorrow I'm going to do it. Tomorrow's going to be the day. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to be so organized. I'm going to make a list. I'm going to do it all. And then tomorrow I wake up and everything goes chaos and sideways. And then I go, fuck, I still didn't. And it's like, you do that for 20 years straight. Every single day, you are just turning yourself into this feeling of just always beating yourself up. And like, and it's something I'm really working on right now, is trying to just accept that, stop beating myself up about it, and then just accept what it is, and then try to figure out how to do the things I want in life with, you know, without being unrealistic about what I'm capable of on any given day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah,
you
sure.
You relate to any of that?
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's kind of a tangent, but I can relate kind of a funny story. Like, I discovered, thanks to YouTube, that like, you know, with certain pieces of electronic equipment, if the battery leaks and stuff, you can actually take water and baking soda and clean off the contacts, clean the corrosion off the contacts.
Okay.
And it'll work, you know, and say, and then you wash it out and then dry it off completely. And then, and you have a functioning piece of equipment again. And my nose hair clipper had that, you know, leakage and stuff. And so I knew what to do, but like,
yeah,
it took me 2 weeks to develop them, to have the mental energy to just finally take the dang cap downstairs, soak the, you know, take the baking soda solution and do it.
Yeah.
And I did it in 5 minutes, but it took me 2 weeks to mentally work myself up to do it, just because. Yes.
I feel that. I feel that, John.
Steps, yeah. You know,
it's, like, it's crazy to try and explain that to someone, but it's how it happens, you know?
I put my laundry away today for the first time in about 2 months.
Yeah.
And every day I'm going to put my laundry away, every single day. Today's the day I'm putting my laundry away. The whole day goes by, I don't put my laundry. So I'm just like pulling clean clothes out of the pile on the like a little sun, like side room where there's like an extra couch, which is just a pile of clothes. And I'm like pulling t-shirts and socks out of that pile and then doing laundry and putting the fresh new laundry back on that pile. And every time I'm like, okay, put it all away. Today I finally did it. But it was like, I've been psyching myself up for 2 months to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I love when you say shit like that. Cause I'm like, yes, thank you. Because when you talk about this shit, it's like, I always feel like if I try to talk about this stuff with like a neurotypical person, I feel like I'm a crazy person. Yeah. Because they just look at me like, just go clean the corrosion off the thing. It takes 5 minutes. What's wrong with you? Why don't you just do it?
Yeah.
It's so. Mm-hmm.
But Ryan, one thing is your show has reinforced for me that like we all need like, especially the more stressed out you are, the more anxious you are, you need those recovery days where, as you say, the only fucking thing you do is fold your laundry.
Yeah.
And that's it. And if you can just do that, that was a successful day. So
yeah,
I thank you for that, because early in your show, you stressed this, like, don't beat yourself up for having rest days. So thank you.
It's really important. And I want to thank you for telling me about using water and baking soda to clean corrosion. Cause I have my little remote control bus that it's stopped working because it got corrosion in the battery. So now in about 2 weeks, I'm going to take this apart.
Starting now.
I'm going to stare at it every day and go, okay, I'm going to do that. And then every day I'm going to go, maybe today's the day, but it won't be. But yeah.
Yeah.
I'll email you in 2 weeks, John, a photo and go, I did it. I did it.
A time-lapse video on a autistic task.
Yeah. But it's so true. There's so many other little things I think about, like little things around the house that like I'll look at and I'll go, oh, I got to do that little thing. And it's like, yeah, it's a 5-minute gig, but I just, what is up?
Don't beat yourself up.
Yeah. Wow. As a librarian, of course, I can't leave without giving you a book recommendation. So
please,
if you see this very well. It's a book called Invisible Differences.
Nice.
Wow.
It's something I discovered in my library's collection, so I bought a personal copy. It's by Julie Duchesse. Originally, I think it was published in French, and it's been translated into English. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a graphic novel about this woman who's autistic and what her life is like. And I haven't read it cover to cover, but I've thumbed through it, and it definitely feels true. So,
wow.
Thank you.
I'm gonna try to find that and order one and add it to my growing autism bookshelf, which is like, yeah. We'll wrap up soon, but I'm just looking at here. You had some notes here about talking about empathy, and that's, I'm always curious to have that conversation too, because that's like the biggest misconception. I think one of the biggest misconceptions is, oh, autistic people don't have empathy. And it's like, a few people that I've told, that's literally been the first thing out of their mouths. What does that mean? You don't have empathy? And I'm like, oh God.
Mm.
I think a lot of NT judgment about our empathetic capabilities, it's a misunderstanding. It's not a lack of empathy. It's a lack of awareness that empathy is called for in such and such a situation.
Yes.
It may take a second to kind of click or whatever that, oh yeah, you know, or, and also the way we practice it, like I made my notes about it. It's like, you know, if you tell me a sad story about a thing that happened to you, my immediate reaction as an ASD person is going to be to cycle back through my memory and try and find something similar that I went through.
Just
relate that to you to let you know, hey man, I've been there. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And well, let's talk this out. And it was a revelation to me that sometimes that pisses off NT people. They think you're trying to dominate the conversation or make it about you. And it's like, no, man, that's not what I'm doing at all. Like ASC to ASD, we understand that about each other.
It's totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It gets to be a problem when it's NT versus ASD that don't understand that what the other is doing. So.
Amen.
That's definitely something that I like consciously try to stop myself when people tell me shit sometimes. And it makes me go, oh, that's like, and like, if it's like you guys or somebody, I would just be able to say that, but I have to go, oh wait, no, don't say that, because that'll be considered offensive, because they'll think it's like, and it's like, well, no, for me, that's showing you that I'm relating. But it's funny, because like you talk about like cognitive empathy, which is like that awareness, that demonstration of empathy in the moment, to demonstrate it appropriately in the moment. So the cognitive empathy is something that we tend to be lacking in, but there are other types of personality traits, let's say, like, you know, like people who are higher or further on, like, you know, narcissist or sociopathic type traits, where they can just nail cognitive empathy, but they don't have empathy. So it's interesting that, like, you can have people that actually don't have empathy, but they excel at appearing as if they have empathy.
Yeah.
But you have
the social cues.
Exactly. But you have autistic people who actually believe that most autistic people have like a hyper empathy. Like it's like a deeper, more powerful, stronger empathy, but it just doesn't present in the same ways. So so people, that's why there's that misconception when people go, oh, well, you guys are just robots. And it's like, no. There's something else going on. It just comes out very differently a lot of the time, you know?
I think ASD people have a profound depth of feeling and deep, you know, even if it's not, maybe if empathy is not the word, we definitely can feel deep sympathy for people and
yes,
have, you know, this kind of compassion and can care about each other. And so,
yeah,
I think underappreciated.
Absolutely. And I think we also, like, I know for like, I know for me, like, there's so many times in life where I have been misunderstood, or like I'm trying, but like somebody thinks I'm being a jerk, or they think I'm being an asshole or something. And that's not my intention, but I get misunderstood. And then people are like, oh, that guy's a prick. He's a dick. He's aggressive, or he's this. And I'm like, no, no. So I think that knowing how often I have been misunderstood, I am like very forgiving of other people, where like people, which is actually sometimes turns out bad, because someone could really be being a dick to me and I'm just going, oh, they're probably just having a bad day, or they don't mean to come off like that, or they don't, you know what I mean? But then really it's like, oh, that person actually is an asshole, but I'm just like, yeah, oh, they're probably fine. They're probably great. But it's just like another one of those things where it sort of flips, and it's like the perception is different than the reality.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of hard for me is my mom will sometimes just accuse me of being rude, and it's like, it's such a shock to me, because it's like, that's not even a thought in my head. I'm not trying to, you know.
Yeah.
But another thing I hear all the time is like, I wish you would watch your tone, or, you know, I don't like your tone. I'm like, what tone are you talking about? I literally can't hear what you're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Or at least I don't perceive it until it's brought to my attention, and then afterwards, and then I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I guess it didn't come out
the best. No, John, honestly, I find you like so direct and so like factual and like logical that it's really easy to listen to you. Well, so
yeah.
Like, nothing against your mom. I'm sure your mom's a sweet lady.
It's just frustrating for me, because I know she's read a lot of autism books and she tries to understand, but it's like, I think she has trouble applying the factual information in the book to her son. It's like, there's a disconnect there. And it, you know, it's like, well, that's what some people, you know, but, and another attitude of hers is like, well, now that you know what the problems are, just don't do those things. I'm like, oh
God.
Oh. Yeah. You know, as if it were, I could go click, you know, and.
Yeah. Oh man. That's a whole nother show.
That brings us to the magic pill question.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the question we ask everybody every show. If there was a magic pill you could take, where you would take the pill, go to bed and wake up, and you would not be autistic anymore, would you take that pill?
I would have to say no, because that wouldn't be me anymore.
Yeah.
There is no neurotypical version of me.
Yeah.
So
good. I like that answer. Like
I love that answer. It's so, I feel, yeah. Cause then it's like, who are you? You know? It's funny, man, talking about your mom. I feel like sometimes with my mom too, I can like be talking to her and my mom's one of those people that never says what she means.
Oh man. All my parents.
Frustrates the hell out of me. And I'll just have to stop and be like, mom, you can't do that with me. Like, and I'm like, I'm like almost getting angry. I'm just like, look, I like, this happened last night. She phoned me and she's trying to like speak in code to like hint at stuff. Cause she's like trying to like ask me a question, but like have me know I'm asking her that question. Cause she's trying to do like, figure out some surprise for my birthday or something. And do I have this thing or need this? And I just was getting so like angry. Cause I'm like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. And I finally had to stop her on the phone and be like, mom, I don't know what's going on right now, but it's like, I'm going to hang up this phone unless you tell me what the fuck you're actually mean, because this is so confusing to me and so stressful that I like, I don't understand it. And then she was like, oh yeah, I'm sorry. We were thinking about something we were going to get for you for your birthday, but we didn't know if you would want it. So I was trying to like hint around and ask if it's, and I'm just like, don't do that with me. Like, I'm like, thank you for wanting to get me a present. That's really sweet. But just don't play these hinting games with me. Cause all it does is like stress me out and make me just get so frustrated where I want to like throw the phone.
Don't play games.
One lesson I can impart from my naval science instructor. He gave great advice for ASD people that he probably didn't even realize he was doing it, but he said, you should always say what you mean and mean what you say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't have problems.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I find
when you speak out, just be like, hey, I messed up, or I can learn from that. Move forward.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a funny thing too. Like, I was just having a conversation on Facebook a couple of days ago with someone who posted in some autism group I'm in about this, like that, this very fact of like neurotypical people, when they don't say what they mean, and then it's our fault that we don't understand them. And then we talk and we say what we mean, but then they think we're speaking in code, but we're not. And then they don't understand us, but then that's also our fault. So it's like,
ASD people are a WYSIWYG interface. You know, what you see is what you get. What you hear is what you get.
Yeah, exactly. Man, this
I hear your point though. I hear your point, Ryan. It's just about like that the people with ASD have to make the change, or the like have the burdens on them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is like, which is the case in any situation where anybody is any type of minority. Then they're, well, that's why our brain type is a disorder, right? It's classified as a disorder because we're a minority. But if we were 80% of the population, then neurotypical would be neurodisordered.
Yeah.
You know? And we'd be like, God, we would have like a diagnosis for these people. We'd go, yeah, here's some of the things of their diagnosis. Like they speak in
code. They never say what they mean.
They never say what they mean. They speak in code. They're, you know, all this other stuff.
Infer informalities.
Yeah. You know, they're really concerned about like hierarchy and status, and they, you know, all this other stuff that like, we would just be like, none of that makes any sense. I don't get it. But, you know,
yeah.
If we got to be the in charge, but you know, whatever.
Hey, the more diagnoses that come out, you know, that might shift the scales here. So
yeah, stay tuned. Well, you know, this COVID vaccine too, right? So,
what? And on that note,
no, I'm just before I get some angry letters, I'm just. Anyway, well, John, is there anything else you wanted to chat about today? I mean, man, this has been really fun. I really love talking to you. It's been so cool.
Just a funny little anecdote with the one girlfriend after the wife. Like, she went out of town for a week once and asked me to look after her. She had three big old dogs that I was kind of scared of, and then she was fostering some kittens in her garage. But she was mainly focused on the dogs. She said, okay, so I want you to, you know, come over every other day and check their food and water and make sure that, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I can do that. No problem. And you know, here's the keys and whatnot. And I said, okay, do you want me to check on the kittens too? And she said, no, don't worry about them. They're fine. I've left them enough food. They'll be fine.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you sure? And he's like, no, it's cool. Whatever. So I was like, okay. And went over and took care of the dogs, even though they scared me. And, you know, just, you know, looked, and they were fine, and the week went by and whatever, and I didn't check on the kittens because she told me not to. And then they came back and turns out she didn't leave enough food for the kittens, and they were really, really hungry, and she got mad at me because of they were hungry. Like, yeah, told me not to worry about them, so I didn't.
Yeah.
Apparently what it meant was, well, oh, they're not a priority, but maybe, you know, you could look in at the end of the week or something and make sure they're okay. It's like, then say that.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. When they say, no, don't worry about it. You don't have to worry about that. Yeah. It doesn't mean actually don't worry about it. It means, like you said, it's not a priority, but you still have to do it.
Yeah.
Didn't you know that? What's that?
Right. Yeah, right. No means yes.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. It frustrates me so many times. I'll work with people and we'll have the same strategy to get something done. And just sometimes you'll say out loud, like, I was thinking this will be the next step. And oftentimes neurotypical people will start their first word with no, and then proceed to do the exact thing that you were doing. Like, that just throws me off.
Really?
It just throws me off to start something that is an affirmative with no. It just throws me off.
Yeah, that sounds really strange.
It frustrates me, man. It's like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. We'll do this first. And then it's like, no. And then, but it's a yes. It just confuses the fuck out of me, man.
They rephrase it slightly differently, but it's essentially the same. And you're like, ugh. Okay.
Fine. Fine. You win.
Yeah.
As long as we're doing the same thing I came here to do, I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so weird.
John, it's been a blast.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, I guess final thing. My other obsession is Japanese anime. I love that art form. And also, I'm a big Star Trek nerd. So.
Oh, for real?
Two of my passions outside of my work life.
What's your favorite Star Trek show? Like which of the different series?
Probably Deep Space Nine, but original series too, you know.
Nice.
So yeah.
Yeah. I'm a TNG guy, also a big Deep Space Nine fan. And yeah, I mean the original, of course, but I grew up in my house, we were all watching Deep Space Nine like every week. So, or sorry, TNG. So a couple years ago, I guess it's a while back now, 5 or 6 years ago when all of them came back out on Netflix. I remember one Christmas holidays, like 5, 6 years ago, I just watched the entire Next Generation, like entire series over the course of Christmas holidays. At the time I was single and living alone and I had, you know, I basically had a week off work and no one, my family was on the other side of the country. So I was just like, all right. I think by the end of the week, it was just my living room was just a pile of pizza boxes. And I was like, done the whole series. That's awesome, though. I love that. Now, do you relate to Data?
Somewhat. Yeah. I was going to say with Japanese anime, I really like analyzing characters and finding characters I think that are on the spectrum and have Aspie traits and stuff. That's a lot of fun to do. And it's like, oh yeah, I know what that person's all about and stuff.
Are there any, like a couple you could name that we could then Google and check out after? I haven't kept up to date with much anime, but.
There is a main character named Tenma, or no, wait, no, I'm going to screw up the name. She's the main character of Bamboo Blade. And she, I think I'm pretty certain she's autistic.
Yeah.
Guys, what year will it be when the lead like superhero in like Marvel their trait is autism?
Soon.
And then the main protagonist of the world only or no, I'm sorry. Shoot. You got me on the spot. Right. Man.
No man, we're here.
Pretty sure it's the world only God knows. The main character is, and then I think there's a library girl named Shiori that is also very spectrum-y.
Now are these like anime films or graphic novels you're talking about?
They're TV series.
TV series. Okay, cool. I'm gonna check those out, the main characters. Yeah,
I can.
And thanks for that book reference too, man. That was huge.
Yeah
I'm gonna order that today. I think it's awesome. I think we'll have, go ahead.
If I think of any more, I can email you later.
Yeah, that'd be super.
Absolutely. Cool. Being a librarian. What were you going to say, Ray?
No, I was just going to say, like, Drew, I think to your question about, like, movies, I think I don't know if I'm just imagining this because my own awareness has been seeing it, but, like, I feel like in movies and TV, we're starting to see more autistic characters. And I wouldn't be surprised if like within the next 5 or 10 years, we even have like an autistic superhero in the Marvel universe or something. Like, I really wouldn't be surprised. I wonder if there are, actually, that makes me, I'm going to Google this. I wonder if there are any in the comic books already, any like autistic characters in like Marvel or DC comics. I don't know. It's been a long time since I checked out comic books, but
yeah. Oh, John, I saw you send us the reference there.
Yeah, that's, I remembered the name after y'all were talking.
Perfect.
Very cool.
We got some homework here.
Yeah, man. We got some cool stuff to check out.
Yeah.
Oh, right on. All right. Well, anything else we got to talk about, guys, or what do you think?
I think we can wrap it, but it's been fun, Ryan. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate you coming on. Yeah, I've really enjoyed our conversation and we'll stay in touch and maybe we'll do this again down the road.
Sounds good, Ryan.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, brother.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John. Mm-hmm. Yo.
Yo. What up?
That was cool.
That was fun. That was dope. I'm gonna kill this. I'm gonna call you on the phone in a sec. Cool?
Yeah.
Okay. Peace, ciao. Man. Thanks, dude. Ciao.
You got it. Anytime.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.